Campus FM presents 100 Years of Women on Campus, produced and presented by Patricia Camilleri. Welcome to this anniversary series remembering 100 years of women on campus. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I shall be looking at this theme from many different angles: the sociological, the statistical, the anthropological, and the historical. I shall be asking questions about life for female students and academics on and off campus, yesterday and today, and possibly also tomorrow. I'm privileged to have with me today Madam Justice Lorraine Shkembri-Orland. The theme of today's program is Women in the Law, and the few words that I'm going to say about my guest will illustrate how admirably suited Madam Justice is to talk about this particular issue. However, firstly, I would like to mention the important fact that Madam Justice Shkembri-Orland, and I have her permission to call her Lorraine, because we've known each other a long time, so I've been given permission to do that. She has recently been elected judge on the European Court of Human Rights. She is the first female judge from Malta to achieve this position on the ECHR, and I would like to take this opportunity to congratulate her on this election, which is significant for her personally, of course, and also for Malta. Lorraine graduated LLD in 1981 and was awarded a Magister Iuris in European Law in 1996 from the University of Malta. During her presidency of the Malta Council of Women from 1988 to 1991, she served as elected member to the Executive Board of the International Council of Women. She took part from 91 to 93 in drafting legislative and constitutional reforms to eliminate gender-based discrimination from the laws of Malta in view of the country's accession to the CEDAW, I don't know whether I'm pronouncing that correctly, convention, which stands for Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. Before being raised to the bench in 2012, Lorraine was chairperson, legal committee advisory to the Office of the Prime Minister on Family Law Reforms, co-drafter of the Family Law, and drafter of legislation on domestic violence. She's a former member of the National Bioethics Consultative Committee and the Commonwealth Expert Group on Gender Equality. A thesis examiner on family law, she has also authored numerous reports and papers on family law, gender equality, and bioethics. As a practicing advocate, Madam Justice specialized in matrimonial and family law before the courts of the civil and criminal competence, including cases with a significant international element on child abduction, divorce and annulment, succession, and estate law. Madam Justice, welcome to you.
Thank you very much, Tricia. I am so pleased to be here. And also, I notice that the purpose of this series of programs is to commemorate and to bring to the fore this 100 years of women on campus in various fields. In fact, I'm a bit embarrassed about you reading the bio, but I would like to say that it is important to have women in every aspect of social, political and civil life and economic life. But throughout the years, the message that I was foremost for me, even as president of the National Council of Women, was that the presence of women at every level of society is instrumental in achieving gender equality, not parity, equality, because there is a distinction. But not only, a democracy requires that every member, and this would equally apply to vulnerable members of society, has a say. And so you are bringing to the table of the decision-making process your experience as a woman and to contribute to a wider view of society and obviously a decision which would eventually benefit not everybody, because you are having all those points of view coming together in to try and resolve problems or address issues and whatever. So basically, the idea of having women in every level is to give a platform to the voice of women. And if you assess what is happening, I mean, I would like to talk about the Istanbul Convention later on, or its certain aspects with reference to the European Convention of Human Rights. Sadly, women are still not being given a voice in society. Not only that, but they are the target of systemic violence, especially in certain areas of the globe.
Yes, those are all extremely important points, and in fact one of the issues that I have been trying to discuss with various participants in these radio programs is the importance, the reasons for the importance of having women with experience in teaching, in engineering, in whatever sphere really. Why is it important? And I think that, yes, it is important, as you're saying, to give that voice. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to sort of widening the scope of the issues, but perhaps we can go a little bit to the particular first and talk about our own university situation. I mean, you've been through the mill kind of thing of the law course.
Yeah.
When you did the law course, probably there weren't so many women
In fact, we were just a handful. As far as practicing lawyers, we had Dr. Ina Cremona, who later went on to become the first female judge of the European Court of Justice, the CJEU. And there was a previous female lawyer who never worked in court, and then after that there were two or three, and then in my course we started out with less than 10 and ended up 5 or 6. I don't remember the numbers exactly, but it was a handful to initiating number of 75. So one can imagine that the imbalance that there was. But having said that, as far as the actual teaching experience or the student experience, and I never felt that there was that I suffered any prejudice. It was something it was quite exciting. There were exciting times. I entered the law course in 75 as a BA student. I was underage at the time, and I remember there were many female students in the arts faculty. But obviously it was a standing year because the law course used to be every 2 years at the time. And then, well, after that, the female presence obviously continued growing and growing, and is now 50%, if not more. Exactly. In fact, you have some statistics here.
Yes, it's called the Master of Advocacy.
Yes.
Changed name. But the statistic of 2017-2018 is 70 females and 47 male graduates.
And one wonders why.
Yes.
Has the law course lost its luster or its attraction? Are they moving into financial services or perhaps others? Has the law course become the traditional arts faculty for females? I don't know what the reason is, but obviously I welcome the figures. But at this time, what we need are good lawyers, basically. The law courts need good advocates. As a judge, as a sitting judge, I had the privilege to sit on the Superior Courts of Malta since 2012, which would count to 7 years. I practically 7 years. It was a privilege to listen or to lawyers who are well prepared, and this is what we need. And to be honest, the female lawyers who appeared in my court were all, if bar one or two in certain instances, extremely well prepared. So if I do bin malti, I'm lujih.
And in fact, very often, I think this has also come across through these programs, that women feel that they have to really make a big effort to make sure that there isn't going to be the discrimination that they're almost expecting.
Yes, exactly. And it's also important, and this is that they make their presence felt, because when you are in court, you have to be heard, and you can't stand for any nonsense, and you can't stand for any, I will use the word bullying very loosely here, but, you know, it's very easy to be intimidated, especially if you're just starting out. So perhaps, I don't really know if it is a gender trait or not, it is important that women who go to the fore in the actual courtroom environment are well trained and prepared for it, to stick to their guns and to make their case. And on the whole, I think that, yes, they are doing a very good job of it.
I think also the courtroom, rather than an office legal job, is or can be an intimidating place. And perhaps you made an interesting point before that, you know, we ought to wonder why the men aren't adding in numbers, why they are not increasing in numbers. Because, in fact, my husband was also in the judiciary, and he used to say, you know, that I always see the same faces, and there's nothing that really shows up any issues than somebody having to stand up in front of a magistrate or a judge and put their case and look at the opposition and look at the judge, and you need courage to do that.
I will confess, Trisha, I was a litigation lawyer. I loved the courtroom. I loved it as a lawyer, and I loved it as a judge. For me, the cut and thrust of legal argument, and is an amazing experience. But you have to love that atmosphere. Not all graduates go for that aspect of the law. But I must say that being a litigation lawyer is obviously more of a challenge for a woman because of the work-life balance which is required. And this is the same of all professions. I used to be a member on the CADERGE, which is the Equality Committee of the Council of Europe. And from years and years and years ago, the main issue was how do you actually achieve a work-life balance. There was talk of having parliamentary hours for women in politics to encourage more women because they would have family responsibilities. But this is the same for every profession. And the thing is, if you take a profession seriously, one can say, yes, I can determine my own hours, but you cannot. Because the exigencies and your duties and responsibilities to your clients, and I'm talking as a lawyer, from a lawyer's perspective, and obviously a doctor towards his patients, and an architect towards his clients, sometimes would militate against the possibility of drawing a line at spilling over beyond a certain hour. So there is need to have certain assistance, because once you're in court, you are subject also to the constraints of the court timetable and the judiciary timetable, and not just the constraints of your private practice, and your work doesn't finish in court. You go to your office, you see clients, you work, you prepare your briefs, you study. So as one can see, you live with it. When I entered the law course, we were the first sitting we had with Professor Guido De Marco. He asked each and every one of us, why did you enter the law? And, you know, some said, I want to do good, I want to help people, whatever. My reply at the time was, I want a profession that I can grow with, and that can grow with me. I don't want a 9-to-5 job, I don't want to go to an office and then go home. Possibly it's nice to go home and then have other interests, which is true. But at the time, to my mind, that is what I wanted. And law, you can never stop learning. This is life, after all. And you learn from the law, you learn from jurisprudence, but you also learn from the persons who you are assisting. And you have connections with these persons at their most vulnerable moments.
Yes, you're talking about mainly obviously your experience has been mainly in the courtroom, either as an advocate or as a judge. But there are those who go into a law firm. Yes. And perhaps have a different trajectory and different possibilities. And I think also there, in that sort of structured environment, women can also be disadvantaged. Yes. I looked at some statistics. These happen to be American statistics, but in actual fact, I suspect that if one looked in the European ones, they'd probably be more or less the same. The idea that comes across from this information is that there are more female lawyers than males, but then when they go into the law firm, they tend to be less likely to get to the upper echelons, to become associate partners. And again, this refers back to this life-work balance that somehow we haven't quite got it yet, have we?
Yes. I think Malta has a different context, because many law firms are what we would call boutique law firms, but there are large law firms, and it could be that the trajectory that women here would follow a similar trajectory in those law firms, because they may need to take more flexible hours or some time off. To be honest, I think that many women today are very aware of what they can or cannot achieve and how they should achieve it. I would hope that that sort of prejudicial attitude would not prevail in Malta, and there are good women lawyers in law firms who are in partnership positions. It may take longer because, as I said, they would need, especially, you know, with family responsibilities, because they do have family responsibilities, they would need time. However, having said that, as a judge, I did experience many male lawyers who took their own family responsibilities quite seriously. Now, I don't know to what extent. I mean, most involved picking up their children from school or play school, etc. But they were carrying their share of the burden, at least in that respect, and possibly also at home. So this is a question of changing society that we live in, because it's not just going to be a female woman's issue, it's going to be a male issue as well.
It should be a shared issue.
Exactly, exactly.
At this point, I'd like to also widen, as we said, the scope a little bit of our discussion, because you've had an enormous amount of international experience through your various committees. Mm-hmm. I will interject here and say that the noise in the background is happy graduates. So I'm sure our listeners will excuse the background noise. So perhaps you could tell me about some of those issues that you have at heart that in which you were involved in an international context.
Well, yes, I mentioned the domestic violence issue, and I was a chairperson of a committee which was set up in the 90s to examine and make recommendations concerning domestic violence problem in Malta. And that was an interdepartmental committee. At the time, many departments were involved, including the police, the social services, education. And the idea was to have a one-stop shop for victims who reported domestic violence at the main points of intake, which would be the hospital, education, possibly through the children, and social services. So we looked at the situation, and there was a very proactive agenda for that. In fact, I'm always quite amazed today that this hasn't yet been put into, I mean, it hasn't all come together. And we do have quite serious cases involving femicide, and femicide, I'm referring to the word femicide as the murder of a woman by family members, as they have in Italy. I'm using it in that context, in domestic violence context. And we have had very serious cases and tragic cases, and also issues of the way the authorities tackle reports of domestic violence. One of the judgments I delivered, which was on the last day, was a case concerning the positive obligations of the state in preventing or redressing frequent reports made by a person concerning domestic violence affected performed. She said she was a victim of domestic violence, so the issue was, is the state fulfilling its positive obligations? So for me, Council of Europe celebrated, and the world commemorated the International Day for the Elimination of Domestic Violence Against Women, and the Council of Europe, which is the European Court of Human Rights, operates as the human rights arm of the Council of Europe together with certain agencies, also has brought into effect the Istanbul Convention, and there's a monitoring committee which monitors the states' parties' work in the context of domestic violence and the implementation of that convention. So there is a lot of work being done and a lot of work still yet to be done within that field. I wanted to mention, I don't know if I am jumping the gun here, but I wanted to say a bit about the European Convention on Human Rights.
In fact, I was going to ask you to expand. Yes.
Yes, because it is important for people to realize that through not only the word of the convention, but through the interpretation of the European Court, States do not only have a negative obligation not to interfere, but they have a positive obligation, even if that has been written in by the courts, to ensure that the rights guaranteed by the convention are secured. Within the context of domestic violence, this would mean that if a person has reported a case of domestic violence, the police have to take immediate effective action. In other words, you have two main thrusts. It has to be immediate and it has to be effective. And this is within the context of right to life, because their domestic violence cases can often lead to death, the protection from inhuman and degrading treatment and torture, because domestic violence often includes physical and emotional, obviously it is within the definition of it, battery. So police cannot just stand back, but they have to investigate. And this is also the entire thread of the convention. In every convention right, you have the negative obligation of the state not to interfere. You cannot kill through your agents, but you cannot sit back and do nothing as if somebody is killed, or if even by a private person. You cannot, and if somebody is killed, or if somebody is tortured, or if somebody is put into forced slavery, or if the person's personal integrity is violated, the state has to, even after the fact, embark on an immediate, effective, and independent investigation. These are the obligations which put the convention into effect, and the main purpose is to act as a deterrent. Because if you don't do that, anybody can do what they like. There will be chaos and then anarchy. The convention will be worth, won't be worth the paper it is written on.
You've also been involved in bioethics on various occasions, and I would imagine that is a real hot subject.
Well, to be honest, I don't even think the Bioethics Advisory Committee, is in existence anymore. This was set up to advise the Prime Minister, the Cabinet, on important bioethical issues like the rights of consent of patients. And in fact, if you go to Mater Dei, you see all the signs, your what consent, so okay, that has been taken in. The issue of surrogacy, for example, IVF, these were taken. The committee was a committee of experts from various fields. And I must say that in many countries, these issues, even rights to life or the living will, these are not implemented immediately by legislation. Many countries, and I'm talking of the countries of the Council of Europe, and do have bioethic committees or expert committees or even expert medical committees to study and implement and study the impact on society. The European Convention itself does not deal with bioethical issues, but the European Court, because obviously we do not have eyes and ears on the ground, if one is to examine an issue concerning extradition or repatriation of a migrant to a country, one would rely on reports by the UNHCR or by the Commission for the Protection Against Torture on the actual country reports to see if that country is a safe haven or not. The same for bioethics. There's the Oviedo Convention, which is the Convention on Bioethics. But it is an area of law on which there is not yet consensus among states on what this particular line should be or that. So states are given what the court calls a margin of appreciation. The European Court does not substitute the domestic courts, but it monitors that all state agents, including the courts, because they are state agents for the purposes of the convention, are implementing the text and the implementing properly the text. Not the spirit, you have to be careful, but the text and of the convention as a living instrument.
That's a fascinating subject, and really I'd love to hear you speak for another half an hour. Just in the last minute that we have at our disposal, I would like to hear how your move now has sort of impacted you. I mean, obviously,
well,
I don't know
how
much you can say, but...
No, it is being a national judge, a domestic judge, and being a judge on an international court. And European Convention has 47 signatories, so there are 47 judges from each state. And all of us are refugees to a certain extent, because we are all translocated. Some with families, some without, some have to commute. So on a personal level, it is quite disruptive. But on a professional level, there are about 900 to 1,000 lawyers who work within the complex of the European Court of Human Rights. And they are all experts in the field of human rights, and in particular areas, cross subject areas like terrorism. So you can imagine, they are brilliant minds. So all of a sudden, you know, it is an apex. It is an apex. It involves a lot of, obviously, a learning curve is a bit too banal, I think. but the information is there, the learning is there, the human experience is there. So at this point, being a domestic judge is extremely important and extremely privileged, because you are the first call. You are the first line of defense of the Constitution and of the law. And I'm talking about the stages. I'm not talking about one court. I'm talking about the inferior, the superior, whatever. But the European Court then is the final stage. So the two together should have a conversation. They should be pulling the same rope in the matter of human rights to ensure the implementation of the convention across the board, to ensure the dignity of the persons within the country, the particular country.
Well, we've come to the end of the program. I really appreciate the fact that you took time out to be with us today.
Thank
Madam
you.
Justice Lorraine Shkembri Orland,
thank
I want
you.
To give
it's
you your full, title, your full title. Thank you so
thank
much
you.
For being with us.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to 100 Years of Women on Campus. If you would like to hear the programs again, just go to www.maltauniversitybroadcasting.com and click on webcasts. Join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye. You have just listened to 100 Years of Women on Campus, produced and presented by Patricia Camilleri.